Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast, where we explode. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a film critic. I write for The Wrap, and everybody calls me Bibbs.
I was going to say you're Don Pardo, but I don't know what you slipped into there at the end.
I don't know, but I like it.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a film critic. I contribute to Slash Film. I do not sound like Don Pardo. I have kind of a thin, weak voice that gets lost in large rooms.
Just once, I want Whitney to introduce himself without putting himself down. If you can think of a compliment for Whitney to introduce himself for on this podcast, please email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And I will stop talking like this now. Sorry about that.
That's appreciated, Vin Scully.
Wanted to see how long I could go before people started turning off the podcast.
Yeah, like, they shut it off already.
Is he just stuck in this mode?
We're done. We just lost all our listeners.
Sorry.
So the rest of the episode is kind of a bonus.
Yeah, no, seriously, we can say whatever we want here. Like, my God.
I will say this about myself. My opinions are all right.
They're all right, yeah.
No, I mean, they're all correct. Every single one of them.
Yeah, sure.
Uh-huh. See, you agree. You said, yeah, sure.
I did say, yeah, sure.
In a completely non-sarcastic way.
Here's the deal. I have been humoring the audience, extending humor to them, and right now I just humored you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. What are we reviewing this week? Because we do actually review films.
We review films.
We don't just get pedantic. Well, we get pedantic about movies, I suppose. Talking about?
We're critics. Of course we get pedantic. Yeah. We are reviewing the new releases, Lee Cronin's The Mummy, which is the Lee Cronin's The Mummy that was directed by Lee Cronin. We are reviewing the new Anne Hathaway, Michaela Cole, David Lowery, artsy, pretentious, but not necessarily bad, Thing, Mother Mary. It's kind of hard to describe. We will do our very best. We're going to be reviewing the new Lorne Michaels documentary, Lorne, about the producer of Saturday Night Live.
We're a friend for life.
We are going to be reviewing another film, which is, believe it or not a documentary about Saturday Night Live. Whitney, what is this not a documentary, and what is it about?
Well, it's a Polish film, and the title is Erupcja. But it's because it's Polish, you know, you have to know how to pronounce Polish lettering.
Which is why Whitney is doing it.
So Erupcja stars Charlie XCX. Yes. It's sort of a Polish hangout movie. We'll talk about that one.
And then lastly, we're going to be reviewing the new Netflix Happy Madison comedy, Roommates, which is, hang on a second,
a Happy Madison production?
Obviously. Mm-hmm. Hold on, I wanted to. Yeah, no, it's about roommates. So there you go.
It's a Happy
Madison. I got a lot of jokes.
It's a Happy Madison production. I missed it, and I don't feel bad about that.
Okay.
You review a lot of. You see more movies than I do, generally speaking.
Generally,
just because I have a 9-to-5 job.
Yes, and my 9-to-5 job is reviewing movies.
Right. If I had a 9-to-5 job reviewing movies, I would. So you talk about these movies that I regret having missed, and
also
have
some
to
that
fight
you don't.
To catch up on, and sometimes you watch. Like shit.
Yeah.
That I am just relieved that I didn't have to see.
See, here's the
thing. It wasn't assigned me and I don't have to talk about it.
Well, here's the thing. And I know a lot of critics who they're not writing necessarily for an outlet. They're not necessarily getting assignments from up on high and they review the films that interest them. And that's great. But my philosophy is I don't know if it's good until I've seen it. So I'm always excited to see a new movie, even if it's something that maybe doesn't look great from the trailer or I'm not necessarily a fan of the filmmaker. With rare exception, I'm always going, maybe it's great. Because wouldn't it be great if it was?
If I were assigned a Happy Madison production, I would, in my professional capacity and just in a humanly curious way, have to watch this thing with an open mind.
Yes,
I would have to be open to the possibility that a Happy Madison film is deeply profound in some way, moving, or just funny.
Or at least just good.
Or just a good comedy. What I can say, all I can comment on is what I've seen.
Yes.
And I've seen multiple Happy Madison productions.
Oh, you've seen many over the years. They've been kicking around for decades now.
A couple dozen, perhaps.
Yeah.
And they have a bad track record.
They don't have a good track record. I'll give you that.
That's all I can really say with
There are a few Happy Madison comedies that I will absolutely go to bat for. House Bunny with Anna Faris. That's a very funny, very solid broad comedy.
Yes.
I'm a fan of House Bunny. There you go.
I haven't seen it since the year 1997, but I remember enjoying Happy Gilmore.
I think Happy Gilmore back technically precedes Happy Madison.
Well, because that's where it gets its name.
It is where it gets its name.
Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore. Yeah.
I don't know. I think technically that's not that the name of that product. I think that production was formed afterwards, named after that. But yeah, Happy Gilmore's funny. Mm. Yeah, agreed. Well, we'll talk about that and whether or not Roommates is a good movie, a bad movie, or just an interesting movie later. But stick around. It might surprise you. Or it might not. Anyway, we're going to start with the biggest release of the week. This is a film directed by Lee Cronin called Lee Cronin's Legally Distinct The Mummy.
They had to put his name on. Lee Cronin is not like a hugely known property. He did Evil Dead Rise and I think one other feature before that.
Yeah, this is only like his third feature film.
And they only put his name on the title because The Mummy, I don't think, is owned, isn't copywritten by Universal Pictures.
Well, you can't just copyright just like a thing. Like, you couldn't copyright...
Vampire is not a copyrightable
name. A vampire is a concept. You can't copyright that. But if your studio, like Universal Studios, has an entire lucrative franchise built around the Mummy brand, they could get in your way if your movie is not... It creates arguably brand confusion.
Yeah.
Like, people might come to Lee Cronin's The Mummy thinking it has something to do with the Brendan Fraser movies. So they put Lee Cronin's up there because everyone knows that Lee Cronin isn't Brendan Fraser, which I'm joking about because I've never seen them in the same room at the same time. Maybe they are. It's the same philosophy that gave us Lee Daniels, the butler.
Mm.
I don't know why it's always Lees that get that possessive nowadays.
Wouldn't it be funny if they called it Lee Cronin's The Mummy, and they had to give the film that title?
Yeah.
And then the studio took it away from Lee Cronin and started mucking with it and re-editing it.
Yeah.
And he got really upset and wanted to take his name off of the project.
Yeah.
So it would be Lee Cronin's The Mummy, directed by Alan Smithy.
That'd be awesome.
That would have been great.
As my understanding, they don't actually... If you don't know what we're talking about...
Well, they retired Alan Smithy a long time ago.
If you don't know what we're talking about, if a director was unhappy with the movie that they made, maybe the studio re-edited it without them, or maybe it just doesn't... There was some reason they want their name off of the project. They're not proud of the work. They don't think they should be credited for it. It used to be that you could take your case to the Directors Guild, and if you made your case, and if the movie wasn't so famously yours that it would be fooling no one, you could have your name changed to Alan Smithy, and that was the name that would be put on every movie where the director had their name taken off the project, and... It's several noteworthy movies have Alan Smithy on them. Sometimes Alan Smithy was the name attached to like the TV edit.
That was true of Dune.
Yeah.
The longer TV version of David Lynch's Dune is credited to Alan Smithy because he didn't approve of that edit.
Exactly. So, but nowadays everyone knows that Alan Smithy is a fake name.
Mm.
So they realize that it isn't really doing any good. So presumably you can still get your name taken off of a project. And presumably you can get that name changed, but I don't know if they let you just make up a name or if there's a brand new name no one's ever discovered yet.
Mm.
But in any case, this is Lee Cronin's Legally Distinct The Mummy. The movie is about an American family in Egypt. They are working. He is a news reporter and she is working in medicine. They have a couple of kids. And one of their kids, their daughter Kate...
And mom is pregnant.
And their daughter Katie is abducted in the opening of the movie by a mysterious figure. And they can't find their daughter, and we cut to 8 years later. There is a plane crash in Egypt, and at the site of the plane crash, they find an ancient, like, 1,500-year-old sarcophagus.
Oh, no, many more thousands of years older than that.
Okay, well, ancient sarcophagus. For some reason, I heard 1,500, but maybe I've got it wrong. And inside that sarcophagus is their daughter, alive, mummified, or at least wrapped in stuff.
Wrapped in what? Wrapped in swaddling clothes and lying in a manger. Yeah. So she's Jesus. That's the twist of the movie.
Oh, that'd be a good twist.
Lee Cronin's the Jesus.
Ooh. But in any case, the authorities find her. They take her in. She is in severe physical distress. She's in severe mental distress. She's deeply traumatized. She's lashing out. She's not communicating. And so the family takes her home. And I'm like, maybe leave her for a bit while we monitor. Like, he's not healthy yet when they take her back.
And this is mom's idea. It's like, yeah, she will heal better at home. And then...
And to be fair, she's like a doctor or a nurse, mm-hmm, or I forget if they say, but she has a degree in medicine. She's not coming out of this from nowhere.
And right away, there are incidents where the recovered daughter, Katie, is very much harming herself.
Yeah.
She's like eating poisonous bugs and skittering around, yeah, and scratching and like actually doing harm.
Yeah.
Like, she needs someone to look after her 24/7.
Yes.
Nobody at home is capable of doing that.
Or qualified.
They have like a whole support system because mom and dad are home.
Yeah.
Grandma is also there.
Yeah.
The younger brother is now a teenager, so he could potentially help out, even though he doesn't, yeah, want to.
And the younger sister is too young to really help.
Yeah.
But still, that's a large family, mm, people who are often home. And yet she has very specific needs. And what they don't realize, and what we do, because it's called Lee Cronin's The Mummy, it's a mummy movie, is that this is a horror movie, and she is not just traumatized, she is possessed by some kind of ancient demonic force,
yeah,
that gradually starts tearing the family apart, psychically, just making them hate each other and, mm, pulling at the rifts already forming, yeah, between them, but also ripping them apart physically, because this is the guy who directed Evil Dead Rise, and he loves himself some gore.
Yeah, yeah. The gore is the most notable detail about this movie.
It's really gnarly and gross.
Like,
they
give this really funky makeup job to the Katie character, like she's been scarred up, and there's scene after scene of like her skin is really kind of peeling up, and it looks really papery. There's a really horrible scene with a toenail clipper.
Oh yeah, yeah. I did not guess where that one was coming. I saw exactly where that was going, because I knew something bad was going to happen.
Oh no,
I didn't know. You knew exactly what was going to happen.
I've seen an animated short called The Hangnail, and that's kind of prepped me for what was going to happen.
It's gross, is my point.
It's pretty gross. And all sorts of horrible things happen. People get thrown out windows. Dogs maul other people. There's a really cool sequence involving some embalming fluid.
Yeah.
There's a really cool scene involving false teeth.
Don't eat the deviled eggs. I'll just say that now. The deviled eggs. It's a good thing this came out after Easter.
Yeah.
Because deviled eggs are ruined for a little while.
And while this demonic presence is clearly like casting spells and forcing people to behave in demonic ways and say horrible things, I don't really get the sense that the family's being torn apart. It's more like a haunted house thrill show.
I mean,
where there's just a lot of really extreme things happening, but there's not
their
like
behavior is changing. Like, and over the course of the film, some of them start acting in very unusual ways.
Because they're under a spell, though. Not because they're being pushed to some kind of emotional extreme.
Well, I think that's part of it, though, is my point.
It would have worked better if, like, the filmmakers had bothered to establish that there were, like, some kind of rifts or discomfort at home.
Yeah.
That the demon was exploiting, but there isn't that. You get more of that in a Conjuring movie, and even then, it's like the sub-story.
No, they do a rather poor job of that, which is frustrating because more than anything, more than a mummy movie, which I want to talk about because this is barely a mummy movie, this film is, you know, a metaphor for taking care of an ailing family member and the toll that it takes on the family. And then we push that, you know, past 10 up until like, you know, if this style goes to 30.
Yeah.
Like, it's the absolute most horrifying possible scenario.
And
I've seen horror movies
like that too, where it looks like somebody's sick, but they're a zombie, or it looks like they're sick and they're possessed.
This goes back to I Walked with a Zombie in the 1940s.
But more recently, the first Insidious movie.
Yeah.
The boy is in a coma.
There you go. Yeah. And that's a risky thing to do because you run the risk of demonizing literally people who have serious health issues and who need assistance from their families. But also, it is also acknowledging that long-term care can take a toll on the family, on the whole family unit. Just the effort of it is a lot. So on one hand, that's fair game. On the other hand, that's pretty dark.
It's pretty, well, what it does is, what the Lee Cronin's The Mummy does is it takes, it just cribs. It takes little bits and pieces of horror films that work better. Mm-hmm. A family being torn apart by an ailing family member and how that's sort of taking a toll on family. And uses it as shorthand. Mm-hmm. We recognize it, but we're just using it to sort of lay some gore on top of it. Mm-hmm. We've seen this possession story work in The Exorcist and its thousand knockoffs.
Well, let's be honest here. A lot of this movie feels like an Evil Dead movie. Especially towards the second half.
Yeah.
Evil Dead Rise in particular, where, oh no, mom has been possessed by a demon. And oh no, daughter has been possessed by a demon. It's pretty similar.
There's a really cool scene where, like, we see some, like, strips of cloth that have spells written on them. Mm-hmm. You could just shift the script a little bit, say that's the Necronomicon, and make it into an Evil Dead.
I mean, functionally, for all the good it does. Yeah. It's this thing, I was thinking about this as, what is, really, a mummy movie? Now, I think there are exceptions here where movies that just happen to have a mummy in them. Mm. But if your movie is about mummy, especially a supernatural mummy, if you look at them throughout history, they're pretty consistently about the way that Westerners rob the graves and the culture of another culture.
Yeah, it's about the dangers of colonialism. You go back to Carl Freund's original mummy from 1932.
Mm-hmm. We open the mummy's tomb?
You open the mummy's tomb. And
we
were talking about this after we saw the movie. I feel kind of ambivalent about the way Egyptian culture has been relentlessly and, quite frankly, racistly exoticized by Hollywood.
Oh, yeah.
Egypt is always seen as this very exotic, ineffable, faraway place. Not like a culture with people. The main characters of mummy movies are hardly ever Egyptian characters.
Yeah.
The mummy, maybe, and they're always played by some guy from Boston.
Well, not exclusively.
Not exclusively. That's
Christopher Lee was from Britain. Yeah. Christopher Lee played the mummy in 1959.
Yeah, Lon Chaney Jr. Played the mummy. And while on one side, this is like we're exoticizing Egyptian culture and we're kind of othering them and making them seem like something that they're not worthy to star in their own pictures, even though we're sort of exploiting their culture.
Yeah.
At the same time, we are at least using that story to vilify white colonialism and also point out that, like, white Americans don't have magic of their own.
We don't have, it's like, never about, like, our gods versus their gods. We don't have gods.
Yeah.
We're nothing.
We're kind of, like, spiritually empty, and we're too culturally ignorant to understand what's happening when it's happening to us.
And I think that's all in there in a lot of these mummy movies, whether it's Stephen Sommers, Carl Freund, 1959. But I think very few of those movies are actually handling that material that way. Like, look at the 1999 The Mummy, a movie that everyone at least likes, in my experience. Like, it's at least, it's
raucous, enjoyable, totally bisexual adventure.
The cast is great.
Yeah.
If nothing else, the cast is great, and it's a sumptuous production, right? It's a fun flick. And yeah, that's about Westerners plundering an Egyptian temple. Desecrating corpses, and oh no, the corpses have come back to life, and we're all fucked.
But we spend a lot of time with the mummy. We get to know him in different forms. We actually understand
him. He has, like, a tragic backstory that he's, like, actually he's sympathetic in a way because he wants to get his love back.
Yeah, he's the villain, but we kind of like him too. So I think
I think that one's interesting, and I think Oded Fehr gets to play not only because there's often an Egyptian character who gets to speak directly the themes of the movie and how you Westerners are all fucked.
Yeah.
Like, you're all assholes. But even in that movie, who do we really follow? Who are the actual heroes? The good Westerners. Who still did that thing, but they feel kind of bad about it. But also, they're gonna kill that ancient Egyptian guy. There's always, like, in almost every mummy movie, there's always something about it that doesn't track with that theme where we want to have our cake and eat it too. We want to wag our finger at the white British people or Americans, but also, some of them are our heroes, right? Some of them are good. They're probably you. You would be the good guy, right? If there were any justice in the world, the 1999 Mummy movie would have been about Oded Fehr.
Yeah.
He's fucking awesome. He's also sexy as hell. He leads like an army at the end. Like, he's fucking cool.
I do wish they had bothered to hire some Egyptian actors.
Yeah.
Because Oded Fehr was born in Israel. Yeah. Arnold Vosloo, the mummy.
Yeah, South Africa.
Is from South Africa. Yeah. His runway model bride, I think, was from Venezuela. Like,
yeah, in the 1959 Mummy, the Egyptian character who raises the mummy to get revenge on Peter Cushing and his father, he's played by an actor from Cyprus. But yeah,
which is geographically kind of close to Egypt.
They're in that general zone, but like, it's still not quite, considering that you are literally. If you're not literally taking artifacts from Egypt, you are usurping the culture for your own. Financial gain.
Yeah.
The least you could fucking do. And I will say this about Lee Cronin's The Mummy. It's like they actually want to take care of some of this a little.
The problem is they try to do it both ways. Mm-hmm. Because there's a great character in this movie. It's the Egyptian cop.
Yes.
Who's rather heroic and actually figures all this shit out. And actually is the one who gives us all the information. She's played by Mae Kalamaui.
Who you may recall as one of the breakout performances from the Moon Knight TV series, which is also
I didn't see Moon Knight.
Yeah, not a great show, but there's some good stuff in it, and she was great. She was fantastic.
She was born in Bahrain, but, you know, they at least give an Egyptian character, like, a little bit of agency in this story.
She's cool. She's saving the day. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, by the end of the movie, she's still relegated to the person who knows about the Egypt stuff. Like, she
to help the
Americans.
The America. Well,
so we're still not really getting, like, we're touching upon it, but we're never really committing to it.
We have a white father and a Latina mother, but they are the Americans.
They're the Americans. They're not from Egypt, are they? And so ultimately, this movie is almost in no way about that interplay between American and Egyptian culture or their values or colonial theft. It's very incidental to the point where didn't have to be about a mummy.
No.
With a small rewrite, this could have been about the Necronomicon. It could have been about fucking anything.
And what I was going to say, in order to kind of... They tried to have like an Egyptian hero, but they also had to have an Egyptian villain.
Yeah.
And there's a character in this movie that is only credited as the magician.
Yeah.
Who is responsible for all of the horror of this thing. And you know,
she's the kidnapper at the beginning.
She's the kidnapper. She's the one who like knows all about sort of black magic and does all these evil spells to sort of make sure all of this evil is perpetuating. And they have to kill her twice in the movie.
The thing is that I think they do attempt at least to make that character, to give that character some complexity, because their motivation for doing what they do is not as straightforward as you might assume.
I suppose not, but she's wicked from the start.
Oh, yeah,
the first scene we see her, she does something kind of mean.
Yeah.
And so we're not on her side anyway, and then she does more cruel things.
Yeah, I think the film wants to suggest by the end of the movie that that character wasn't pure evil and maybe was doing the right thing in a very terrible way.
Mm.
But as you pointed out, once you know the whole plot, why, quote-unquote, the magician did what she did and how it all connects to everything, what she did doesn't make sense on a pure story level. Mm. Like, why she kidnapped Katie specifically, I won't go into detail because it's a major plot point, but, like, considering her motivations, it makes no sense to kidnap an American kid.
No.
If anything, that's the last thing she should do. And I'm not trying to tell her, you know, how to be a better villain, but she would be a smarter villain if she did not do this. It makes no sense for her.
I had to ask the rather grim question of, why don't they just prey on the homeless?
A child who wouldn't have
cops looking for
Americans could be an international incident at that point, considering it's like, you know, a semi-famous reporter.
And if it was, you're
kind of playing with fire at that point.
And if it was, how cool if like Interpol got involved in like a mummy mystery?
Yeah,
and like presidents of various nations had to comment on like the existence of mummies.
Yeah, I feel like
all of this is like lurking in the edges. All of this is sort of endemic to mummy movies in general.
Right. But my point is that all of this is actually very Fringe. We're talking about it a lot, but it lifts out of the movie very easily.
Right.
Because ultimately this is just about a family dealing with a cursed / possessed family member and falling into ruin and violence. And that stuff works pretty good. Like, it was, I thought the gore and the intensity of the horror as it escalates, especially in the second half, was pretty fucked up. I was entertained.
That's what I like about this movie.
Yeah.
Is that it's fucked up. The gore is gnarly. It's too long.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be over 2 hours. That's ridiculous. Yeah,
there's a lot they could have shaved out, but
the ending feels really tacked on.
Yeah, well, the epilogue feels like it was tacked on. The climax felt like something out of a Conjuring movie, which, you know, in the third act of those movies, just all hell breaks loose.
Yeah.
All the ghosts are flying around and there's furniture going everywhere. Same thing, just imagine more blood.
Yeah.
I kind of hope this film is a hit, even though I don't like it that much.
Yeah.
I hope it's a hit because I want to see studios start to imitate that.
Yeah, go for broke.
How great if, you know, mainstream horror movies were now just as revolting as possible. Try to find new ways to show me gore.
Yeah.
I like that stuff. You know, when people are peeling their skin off and doing twisted stuff and there's like weird implications of like incest and cannibalism, like just throw it all in there. If you're going to shock me, really shock me.
Yeah, go wild.
And so, yeah, I'm, like, watching these movies and people are getting their skin pulled off. And I felt like an asshole because there were some scenes where I was just laughing. It's like, like in this wicked asshole.
I think they want you to, though.
Yeah.
I think there's a certain, I mean, the thing I think about with Lee Cronin, I didn't see his first movie, but I saw Evil Dead Rise. I didn't love it, but I appreciated that it was made with a certain demented glee.
Yeah. There's a monster at the end that I thought had a lot of creativity to its design.
Yeah. I was harsh on it, I think, at the time, and I think I've softened. I still think it's the worst Evil Dead movie, but that still leaves a lot of room to be good. But I think what Lee Cronin is good at least of the two movies that I have seen, is managing to take movie violence, extreme movie violence, horror movie violence, and make it actually hurt again. Make it actually squeal. Like, oh no, don't do that. And I think it would almost be nice if he was having a little bit more fun. Like if he was like letting us in on the whimsy. Like, can you believe we're getting away with this, guys? Like almost like a Peter Jackson, Sam Raimi kind of way. But he's not them. He is applying that same inventiveness, that same giddy glee. But the giddy glee is all at the conceptual phase. The actual implementation, the execution, is very harsh, which gives you that thrill of creativity, that gives you that thrill of inspiration, while still making it actually scary. It's never like Three Stooges, oh, we're just going to walk into zombies with a lawnmower. You know, like you can't not laugh at that. That's ridiculous. But if Lee Cronin did that or did something similar, it would probably be the same basic scene, but somehow he would infuse it with more tragedy and pain. So I think he's an interesting filmmaker, and I think he needs to, I think he needs room to grow. I think I would love to see what he keeps doing. But I do think I would like to see what he would do with, I mean, and again, I haven't seen his first movie, but I'd like to see what he would do with a movie that wasn't Evil Dead, because Evil Dead Rise is Evil Dead, and The Mummy is kind of Evil Dead. It's not, if you, with a few minor changes, it could have been Evil Dead 5.
It could have been Evil Dead, yeah, you could have said Evil Dead, Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
You also could have had The Exorcist, Egypt. This would have made just as good an Exorcist reboot, would have been better Exorcist reboot
been a lot
than
better.
That awful Exorcist Believer from a couple of years
this
ago.
This would have been the best Exorcist movie since Exorcist 3.
Yeah.
That's a low fucking bar, but it would have been the best
Exorcist movies since then.
Been pretty bad. And to be fair, of the Exorcist 1, 2, and 3, only 1 and 3 are good.
Yeah, even Exorcist 2 is abysmal.
I heard that TV series that they did with Gina Davis actually was pretty solid. I only watched the pilot and I didn't see it yet, but I heard it got better.
Yeah, I didn't see the TV series. I did see a stage production of The Exorcist that was really interesting. Yeah.
I saw
that one did it pretty well, too.
I didn't get to see it in person, but I got to see, like, a filmed version of the Evil Dead musical.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was fun. They had a good time.
It's cheeky and
it's
cute.
Of course it's cheeky. It's Evil Dead. That's part of it, you know? Enjoy. But anyway, we're getting off topic. Lee Cronin's The Mummy. It's a mixed bag, but I do think the good outweighs the bad in terms of a simple spill your popcorn horror movie experience. It's got problems.
It has all the problems, but these are problems with making a mummy movie. Right. Lee Cronin isn't, apart from his treatment of the magician character, I don't think he's trying to do anything actively hurtful. He's just perpetuating hurtful Hollywood ideas.
I think people just haven't really been taken to task for mummy movies enough.
I think if the film is ignorant to those things, I'm guessing a lot of audience members are going to be as well. And you're going to go to this movie and just see a lot of really nasty gore, and you might throw up a little in your mouth and have a great time. And especially if you've had a few drinks on a Friday night, you're going to have a good time.
Yeah. All right, next up, we've got a new film from David Lowery. David Lowery.
He's such an artist, in all capital letters.
And I don't even mean that in a bad way, because I agree with you, but there's a certain glorious pretentiousness to his films, where he is not afraid of being labeled extremely pretentious. Now, I think I didn't see The Old Man and the Gun, but I do know that his Pete's Dragon, which I actually think is very good, it's a very loose remake of that movie. Like, basically, there's a guy named Pete. He has a dragon. We changed everything else.
I like everything but the dragon in that movie. Okay, well, take the dragon out. You have an interesting family drama.
I think that movie's quite lovely, but that's a very accessible movie. All of his other movies that I've seen are very artsy-fartsy. You've got A Ghost Story, which...
I did like A Ghost Story.
There are things I like about A Ghost Story, and when I first saw it, it really affected me, but the more I thought about it, the more it annoyed me.
The way the afterlife loses track of time is a concept that I really dug.
No, Casey Affleck... I know. Casey Affleck dies, and he's, like, covered in, like, a sheet at the morgue, but then he like wakes up as a ghost, still covered in the sheet, old fashioned Charlie Brown
little round black ghost eyes,
and he's haunting his house, and he's haunting it even after his girlfriend, racked with grief, leaves, and he's seeing still all these other people, and just time starts losing all meaning, and he's there for like essentially eternity, and there's a certain gloomy poignancy to that. Then, when they did Pete's Dragon, there was,
The Green Knight.
We skipped it around a bit, but yeah, he did The Green Knight, which is the adaptation of that classic King Arthur story.
Yeah, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight by Anonymous.
Famously
Translated from Old English by Tolkien. It's a great version of Tolkien's Sir Gawain and the Green Knight that you can get out there.
It had been previously adapted twice before by the same filmmaker, if memory serves. At least one of them had Sean Connery as the Green Knight, which I have some affection for, even though they're very dated. That adaptation of the Green Knight, I will say this, sumptuous.
Some good design in that, some great
very good
photography.
To look at.
Really trying to push just sort of visually what this kind of story can do. You called him gloriously pretentious. I think the more you know, like, pretense means, like, you have to have some kind of foreknowledge.
They expect you to have done the reading. They expect you to know The Green Knight. They expect you to know,
I feel like it's the opposite. I feel like he didn't bother doing the reading, and he's trying to throw some, like, modern interpretations of a text he's not too familiar with.
Yeah.
And as such, it feels incredibly adolescent to me.
Yeah.
It feels like it's not the least bit deep, despite how visually gorgeous it is.
Like, I like the ending. I think the ending brings it around and makes it feel like it's, you did the reading, but it's... I'm going to compare it to Wuthering Heights, but it's better than Wuthering Heights. Emerald Fennel's Wuthering Heights. But I'm going to compare it in that you made a very handsome movie. I think you would fail the book report.
Yes.
But you know what? It's a loose adaptation. You can do whatever you want with it, technically. And I would argue that The Green Knight is at the very least more interesting in its own merits than Emerald Fennel's adaptation. The point is that when you watch a new David Lowery movie, you're expecting big swings. Lots of very luscious and portentous cinematography, characters saying things that sound ever so terribly important, and maybe are, and maybe aren't, but sound like it. And his film, he is
speciously artistic.
Yeah.
He feels like he's artistic.
Yeah, he calls attention to how artistic he is, and maybe some people really love his work and they think that's justified. I'm kind of half and half on him. I think he can be amazing. I think he can get his head kind of stuck up his own butt sometimes, which a lot of artists who think of themselves as serious artists can do, even if they're really good. So Mother Mary is his new film. It stars Anne Hathaway as a pop music sensation, one of the biggest pop stars in the world, clearly modeled after Taylor Swift.
Which I didn't read because I'm not familiar with Taylor Swift.
Yeah, I mean, like, she's kind of an amalgam of several figures, but Taylor Swift in particular.
A what?
An amalgam?
Amalgam.
Sure. really?
It's pronounced amalgam.
Great.
Stress on the second syllable.
Okay.
Sorry.
I learned something today. I never say that word out loud.
You said something about gum, and I wasn't sure.
Yeah, it's an amalgam.
Amalgam.
Of multiple pop icons, but in particular, if you look at like the footage we see of her character's name is Mother Mary, of Mother Mary's tour, it has a lot of inspiration from Taylor Swift's Reputation and Eras Tour, in that it is, you know, sort of it is summarizing her entire career. A lot of like the production design is very similar, the sort of confessional quality of the songwriting. So she's playing off of that mentality. And she has gone through some kind of mental collapse. She needs to completely redefine herself. And for whatever reason, she's decided that she needs to do that through her next costume at her next performance. She doesn't like what her costume designer has done. So she has returned to the costume designer who helped her create her signature look in the first place. But they've had a falling out, and they haven't spoken in, like, 10 years.
Yeah, and she's played by Michaela Cole, an actress I really like, actually.
She's fantastic in this movie.
And she's very striking. She has, like, a fantastic face. Like, you just want to stare at this actress. She was in Black Panther. That's where I first saw her.
Yeah.
I guess she was in the second Black Panther. And Anne Hathaway, the Mother Mary character is... I'm not sure if the movie is trying to mock how pretentious she is, or if we're just supposed to accept that, like, her demands are kind of a natural part of this universe.
Right.
She goes to Michaela Cole and says, I need you to find the real me.
I need a dress that has clarity.
Like, everyone, like, what about all those other costume designers? They didn't do it quite right. So... In order to now make this dress, they have to explore her soul, and the whole movie becomes this two-hander therapy session where they're talking about their past together. I took from this that they were 100% most certainly lovers. Like, that seemed pretty obvious to me, that these were two women who had previously had an affair and had some sort of falling out. That's the only way to explain the intensity of their relationship.
Yeah, because Mother Mary fired her costume designer, and they worked together, they were artistic collaborators, but the level of betrayal, the emotional intensity that they play into that relationship reads far more like a breakup, or at the very least like family. There was a much deeper emotional connection than just employee.
And they talk a lot about, and especially the Michaela Cole character, she talks a lot about how her one-time affection for Mother Mary has turned into a seething, simmering hatred.
Yes.
She just, like, hates her more than anything. Like, that's the only thing that was driving her forward for many years.
Yeah, that's what caused her to build her own career, is basically just, my hatred for you made me want to do something different.
Yeah.
So they have to overcome that baggage, and the movie takes place, I mean, there's a lot of flashbacks, but basically in real time over the course of a night as they go through their shit, and over the course of the film, there are flashbacks, there are bizarre dances, there are very poetic explorations of what they're feeling, and eventually, we do get into some ghost shit.
Yeah, they reveal they've been contacted by a similar ghostly entity that looks like a red handkerchief.
And that may be a metaphor, that may be literal. The movie is open for interpretation, I feel.
The way they present the red handkerchief, it's all very vaginal.
It's definitely about women's energy,
George O'Keefe. There's no men in the film at all, in fact.
I don't think a single one.
Not a single male in the entire movie. there's a lot about sort of the highfalutin language that I really kind of started falling into. There's a really crackerjack sequence where we see Mother Mary going up on, like, from backstage, we see her going up on stage, and then there's a hard cut to her walking off stage on the right side of the screen.
As if it was all one shot.
Yeah, and like, she's, like, really exhausted, and then goes right up onto a next stage, all in one pan, and, like, this big tracking shot, and that's a really cool sequence.
It reminded me of the doorway chase in Sam Raimi's Crime Wave, but very, very, very musical and romantic.
I wish this movie had more energy.
Yeah.
As much energy as Crime Wave. Crime Wave is not a good movie.
Oh, it's a terrible movie, but it's got energy.
Yeah.
Probably the only people comparing that movie.
David Lowry has no energy. He's a very low energy director. There's not a lot of zest and pop to his movies.
I feel like his investment, his energy, his excitement comes from the almost obsessive fascination with... What's what I'm looking for here? Okay. I feel as though this movie is very difficult to... okay, he's stumped me. He's all taken away words. No, here's what I do. I don't know if this is a movie about fascinatingly pretentious people or if it's just a pretentious movie. Possibly both.
I wish there was a little bit of like self-awareness there.
It's not camp, which is why it's actually camp.
Camp can't create itself. That's one of the main rules of camp.
Yeah.
If you read Susan Sontag.
I think the definition has gradually come to accept that camp can be intentional, but I think what we're talking about is camp is people who take their work very, very seriously, but can only be appreciated by outsiders as something humorous.
Something risible,
Whereas if you're doing it on purpose, it's more like kitsch.
Yeah.
That's, you know, you're very, it's very an winking aesthetic, and self-aware. Yeah. And this is not winking and self-aware. No, it is deeply serious about itself.
I mean, the reason I think it's queer is, like, I see the bitter tears of Petra von Kant all over this damn thing, which is a Fassbinder film about two women who are gorgeously overdressed sniping about their past sexual relationship.
Right.
And most of the movie takes place in one room. This feels like a stage play that got out of hand. It feels like a college short film that got way out of hand.
It's got that. That's the thing with David Lowry. He's got this college level pretentiousness where someone who is like clearly very talented, clearly knows like where to put a camera, clearly has something that they want to say. But what they want to say isn't necessarily clear or focused or even necessarily mature half the time. It's just kind of a big miasma of big ideas. And I feel like Michaela Cole and Anne Hathaway, who are both great in this, it's up to them to find the humanity in this big old lump of artistic stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to try to find a way to take this almost inhuman amount of pretentiousness and characters who live so far outside of and speak so far outside of the way that almost any human being actually talks. And I need to find a way to make them and their world real. And I think they do an admirable job. And I think they're the reason why I didn't tune out completely, because I very easily could have if they weren't perfect.
And they mesh well. Like, they have good on-screen chemistry, these two actresses. I wish I got a little bit more of a sense as to what kind of musical artist Mother Mary was. We see her performing.
She's a depressing pop artist.
She sings
depressing songs.
Her songs like pass through the brain without leaving any kind of mark whatsoever.
You can barely hear
her vocals. The one that they played over the credits was okay.
I think that's the best one. Yeah. I think that's the one where I can actually I can hear that and go, that might have done well. That might have been a successful song.
I don't think something like that would have charted, if that's what you mean. But,
I don't know if you're listening to what's going on the pop music charts right now.
Well,
but
I know it's all sad boy music right now. It's all really mellow. Like the high energy hard rock and stuff, far away from the pop charts right now.
Well, even just pop music in general. I mean, there's fun stuff out there. Like, you know, Taylor Swift's Opalite is a catchy ditty, but like. When you think about like how pop music used to be stuff like ABBA, which is actually very bright and very musically complicated, and there's a very different quality. I'm not a music critic, so I don't know exactly how to describe it, but there's just a different level of emotional and technical and producerial intensity to what we're seeing right now. And I think this movie is more indicative of that. Yeah. It's more, it's speaking more to really what's been going on musically lately in that particular vein.
So David Lowery is trying to make some sort of big artistic statement about modern pop and about the personalities we tend to worship, but he's not connecting with a crowd at all. It's just about the figures themselves.
Yeah,
it's about the costume designers. It's about how the aesthetic of the pop star is the thing that drives them, not the art.
Well, I don't know about that, because I think ultimately, as we get to know Mother Mary and we find out why she had a breakdown, for example, we start to see like what she is putting into her music and how her music sort of represents her own sadness. I think what this movie is to me at the most interesting level is a story of artistic collaboration. Two people who actually brought out something really good in themselves. And when they separated, they may have continued to do good work, but it was less than the sum of the parts.
Yeah.
And this is about them trying to find a way. This is like Lennon and McCartney meeting 10 years later and saying, maybe we should do one more album.
You know, God, like, don't give David Lowery ideas.
My point is this. I feel like that's basically what he's doing. He's talking about the collaborative spirit. The ghost in this movie, I feel, was very representative of sort of the artistic link that they shared, and how that will always be a part of them even after they move on. I also feel as though this movie is, and I wish that it engaged a bit more with this, because Anne Hathaway's character clearly benefited in a very tangible and even financial way from Michaela Cole's character defining her, not just her aesthetic, but like her character.
Yeah.
She appears on screen. She's always wearing like on stage. She's always wearing like a halo and robes. And she credits Michaela Cole's character for that. Which means that she's basically taken the work of a black artist and
co-opted
it. Presumably she was paid, but now I didn't hear any suggestion of money changing hands for this new dress. It's basically like, I have lost my mojo. I need you to give it back to me. There is definitely a wealth or fame discrepancy here, although Michaela Cole is now playing a famous fashion designer, but there's definitely a talent or power discrepancy here, and also a racial discrepancy here, where a white artist is co-opting a black person's work or needing that black person to elevate and define their own material.
I wish David Lowery were wise enough to say that, or have something about that in the movie.
He talks about everything else. Every other aspect of their relationship other than explicitly saying that they're queer. Like,
I mean,
it's weird that that's not in there. But it's weird that that's not touched on it at all, though. But really, the queerness is subtextual. I don't think he understands that there's a racial dynamic at play.
Yeah.
Which is frustrating, because he's clearly thinking about everything else.
And I walked away from that. I reviewed this film on KCRW, and I described this film as these two characters as ex-lovers who are getting back together. And it took my co-host, Alison Willmore, to point out, they don't actually say that in the movie, that they were ex-lovers. No. Like, did my brain just put queerness into something again?
I think it's a fair take, though. I just never explicitly stated. So it's open for interpretation.
I suppose so. It seems so clear to me that I didn't even think it was an interpretation. I thought it was explicit.
I think it's definitely using there's physical intimacy.
Yeah. There's just all the bitterness. It all felt like a romance.
Yeah.
It didn't even feel like subtext.
Yeah.
If you were to ask me, I would put, I would program this at like a queer film festival about these two women who were lovers.
I think it would fit. And I would be incredibly surprised if the queer subtext, allegory, or possibly just unspoken, but they was always canonical. I would be very surprised if that wasn't discussed at the very least by the actors, because it's very clear it has that energy, this like jilted lover energy. The amount of, you've come crawling back and I will give you what you want, but I must rake you through the coals first.
Yeah.
For all the hurt that you've done. That's so deeply personal. That's not a working relationship thing.
We had a conversation. I said, if they're like just friends, they're just friends the same way Achilles and Patroclus were just friends, you know, the way scholars describe them.
No, they're hetero life mates.
Yeah.
Yes.
We're just good
roommates.
A lot of people have
found
inscriptions from like old textbooks where it's like, here's an inscription, like an illustration of two women in bed together. And the caption's like, nobody knows why these two women are in bed together. there was a handmaiden was just really good friends with this one.
And again, technically that may not actually have been literally said out loud, but... Mm. Come on.
Come on.
We all know, right? Like,
were the authors of that textbook being cheeky? It's like, we don't know.
I think some people...
Maybe.
There was a time when... oh, God. What's his name? Linda.
Linda.
No. Who was the musician who, like, played piano with a chandelier?
Who played Liberace?
Liberace. I thought it was like Linda Rachi. No, Liberace. I'm all over the place there.
Okay.
But Liberace, there was a time when Liberace was in the closet.
No.
Most people knew, but a lot of his audience didn't. Mm. Either because they were oblivious or they just didn't want to know.
They joked about that in the Austin Powers movie.
Yeah.
Like, frozen in the 60s, awakened in the 90s, and he couldn't believe that Liberace had come out as gay.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you watch Good Night and Good Luck, there's a bit where, they have to interview Liberace. So,
it takes place in the mid-50s.
Yeah, they're interviewing Liberace, and they're like, so when are you going to settle down with the right woman? And, like, he fucking knows. And Romero's like, I have to pretend. Okay, fine. Whatever. Whatever you say.
It's a good movie. Good night. And good
luck. It's a good movie. It's very. I didn't see the stage play, obviously, because I live here. But I had heard mixed things. But the movie's really good. All right, we should move on.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. Forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Do you want to talk about, because I think we got two good segues here.
All right.
There is a behind-the-scenes documentary about a collaborative ongoing work of art, very poppy, or a movie about two women who are roommates. Which one makes the most organic sense to you
on? Why don't we just charge headlong into Roommates, because I want to know what this thing is.
Roommates. Roommates is the newest comedy from Happy Madison. It stars... Sadie Sandler, yes, they are related, not a coincidence, and Chloe East. And Sadie Sandler plays a teenager who has never had a best friend before. Like, she's very nice, loving with her family, but she's socially awkward, and she never really made close friends, and she's never had anyone she would even call a best friend, and she's worried she's going to go to college and never get to know anybody. At one of the sort of getting to know you events before college, she meets a very outgoing girl played by Chloe East, rebellious, hard drinking, covered in tattoos, and they hit it off. And they become fast friends, and they decide to be roommates together when they move into the dorms. And so they do. And at first, everything is great. And this roommate seems to be, like, very, you know, very positive on Sadie Sandler. Like, she's actually, like, getting her to, like, you know, hey, do you want to go out? Only if my roommate's okay with it. You coming with? Like, it's actually, like, very positive for a while. But over time, the cracks start to show, and the relationship starts turning toxic. First in kind of little ways, but and in ways that, well, maybe not little, but it's hard to say whose fault it is.
Now, like, this is a comedy film, though. So is the evil presented as, like, comedic, well, out
he, acting out? That's what makes this movie actually interesting. Especially for a Happy Madison movie. Because on one hand, they're the original odd couple. She's relatively conservative, or at least reserved. And the other one is very outgoing party girl. And over time, Sadie Sandler comes out of her shell a bit and actually, like, finds more friends and becomes more confident in herself and starts living the life she wants to live. But she also starts realizing that Chloe East is fucking with her. Maybe intentionally, maybe not. But there's always, like, plausible deniability to it.
Okay.
Like, they're going to go to spring break. And Sadie Sandler comes from a very comfortable upbringing. And Chloe East doesn't. She says she's comes from a very poor family, and so she can't afford to get, like, plane tickets to go to spring break with all their friends. And so Sadie Sink offers...
Sadie Sandler.
Sorry, Sadie... Yes. Very different. Sadie Sandler. There aren't enough Sadies, I feel. At least I didn't say Sadie Frost. Sadie Sandler basically offers to pay her... You gotta pay me back, but I'll pay it. And it's like, you did offer. She didn't make you do that. And then later on, when Chloe East is, like, feeling very sick... And it's like, oh, but I have this paper due. Sadie Sandler offers to write it for her. You shouldn't do that. First off, that's unethical.
Yeah.
But also, you shouldn't fucking do that. And you
or help. It's like, okay, you're sick in bed. Dictate from bed.
What is happening here is that there is actually a very real conversation happening for a while where, on one hand, Sadie Sandler is starting to get very frustrated with Chloe East's character, and she's starting to feel very used and starting to feel very insulted. And at the same time, Chloe East is still being a very good friend in many ways. She visits her family for Thanksgiving and is very, very nice to everybody and is very supportive of Sadie Sandler's brother, who is clearly gay but has not come out of the closet yet, and she's very supportive of him. She even, like, saves Sadie Sandler's grandmother's life.
Oh, wow, okay.
So, like, is this a situation where Chloe East is this, like, a single white female terrible thing that's about to happen, which the movie leaves some room for? Or is it just bad communication? Like, is the problem here that Sadie Sandler, who never really had a friend before, has also never really had to set boundaries before? And so I'm watching this and I'm like, okay, so is this an it's an interesting film about their relationship in many ways. And I'm not sure if the way that this is going, I'm supposed to be increasingly horrified by Chloe East, or am I supposed to be increasingly horrified by Sadie Sandler's character, who starts turning more and more dark as the story progresses, even though there is at least a decent chance that she is overreacting to everything. And that's a very interesting character dynamic for a Happy Madison movie, but really any comedy. There's a certain complexity there.
Yeah. There, I've seen a few movies that have something similar to what you seem to be describing. Going back all the way to something like In Cold Blood, there's a line in Cold Blood, the movie, about how these two men committed a horrendous crime. It's a true story. And they talk about how, as individuals, neither of them would have done that, but they kind of, in being together, brought out the worst and kind of goaded each other into committing this crime together as a unit.
Yeah, you're right. The Happy Madison comedy Roommates is exactly like In Cold Blood. You're right.
Yeah, well, there are other comedies. Like, well, what was the comedy with Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi?
Neighbors.
It was called Neighbors.
Yeah, that's another one.
Something like that.
Or What About Bob?
I didn't see One About Bob.
It's much more, like, it's a very different dynamic because it's about a therapist. Richard Dreyfuss plays a therapist, and his new patient, Bill Murray, has a lot of problems. Mm. But he takes them on like right before he goes on vacation. And Bill Murray follows him to his vacation. Mm. And Richard Dreyfuss is horrified by this. Yeah, this is stalking behavior.
You're not allowed to do this. Yeah.
But his family is very inviting and actually is very nice to Bob. And everything Bob does ruins Richard Dreyfuss's life, but is also deeply sympathetic. Mm. And his family starts siding with Bob more than Richard Dreyfuss. And by the end of the movie, Bill Murray is sane and Richard Dreyfuss is insane. It's a really, really interesting comedy. Mm. Now, the problem with Roommates is that, unfortunately, it's not very funny.
Well, these kinds of stories can't be. If you're gonna follow through, it has to go to some pretty bleak places.
Yeah, it never goes quite as bleak as it could, but it goes a little bleaker than I thought. Mm. Like it actually takes multiple characters to task for pretty horrendous shit that I was reasonably confident the movie wouldn't take him to task for. Mm. The kind of stuff that like people might write off in a comedy, and then years later you go, you know, it's actually kind of fucked up. We never really talk about how that part of that movie is really fucked up. But by the end of the movie, it's like, no, that was fucked up.
Mm.
And kudos for that. I do believe that one of the characters is... You work really, really hard to make every bad thing that they do seem very... If not sympathetic, at the very least, we understand why they did it and we feel kind of bad for them. Mm. Like, you still deserve comeuppance, but I don't think you're necessarily evil. I think you're just fucked up.
Mm.
And I feel like by the end of the movie, one of them is just sort of completely vilified, and I thought they did too much work humanizing them to get away with that, which is frustrating. But, yeah, I admired the character work. I admired the introspection. I feel like a lot of Happy Madison movies... again, there's some good ones. I think House Bunny is really sweet and very funny. I think even the first Paul Blart is, although very generic in a lot of ways, it's a sweet film. It's actually got its heart in the right place. But a lot of Happy Madison movies don't feel like they were made by sensitive people. Like House Bunny
tend to celebrate bullying.
Yeah. The things that they find funny are the things that a bully would do. That's the big distinction between Paul Blart 1 and 2. Paul Blart, I wrote this in my review, Paul Blart feels like it was made by people who knew what it was like to be bullied.
Mm.
And Paul Blart 2 feels like it was made by bullies. Yeah. Because what they think is funny is hurting people.
Mm.
And comedy can be pain.
Yeah.
Pratfalls and oh no, I'm horribly embarrassed. Something terrible happened to me. But in order to make that funny, you have to understand the nuances of where the audience's sympathies lie. And where you can go too far and lose us and make us not think about how funny it is and think about just how sad it is.
How is that person being made to feel pain?
Yeah.
If we are mocking them for their size or their gender or their race, those are not okay.
Yeah, that's not sympathetic. That's not something I can enjoy in the audience. I think it's meanwhile, in poor taste.
I will find it incredibly funny if some random person who has done nothing wrong is repeatedly punished and injured and smashed in the head throughout a comedy film.
Yeah, look at Time Bandits. There was a recurring joke in Time Bandits. They traveled to all these different time periods. Mm. And in every time period, Michael Palin and Shelley Duvall play doomed lovers.
Yeah.
And something terrible happens to them. They do not deserve it, but it happens to them every time.
Yeah, and it's almost like fate mocking these people. And I think that kind of humor is kind of funny.
Well, because we understand what it's like to be like the universe is shitting on us. Mm. But if the reason they were being shit on was someone didn't like their religion or something, then it's just like, well, I know that hurts. That's actually like, that's really close to home. So I appreciate that this is a Happy Madison movie that is actually kind of introspective about that.
Mm.
But it doesn't necessarily make it funny.
Who made this one? Was this Dennis Dugan again?
No, it wasn't Dennis Dugan. It was a guy who hasn't made a lot of comedies. Hang on. Look that up for me while I vamp for a second. But yeah, no, the problem is that it's just because there's actually more complexity than usual, the actual odd couple humor of it can't really function. I mean, Neil Simon could get away with it in The Actual Odd Couple, but even Neil Simon was just like, a lot of the joke is he's really fussy and he's a slob. Really simple. These characters actually are too complicated to fit into those tiny little boxes. So that simple contrast, we see things very differently. We care about very different things. We sort of exasperate each other. That can't be funny. I feel like what they try to add like some like weird jokey humor. Mm. Like to a lot of it in order to sort of alleviate that, but I feel like the movie doesn't want to be that funny.
Huh. This was directed by a Canadian director I'm not familiar with named Chandler Levac.
Yeah.
And she has directed films I haven't seen. We Forgot to Break Up. That's a great film title.
Yeah.
Mile End Kicks from last year starring Barbie Ferreira.
Yeah.
Based on her own life and her writing of a book about Jagged Little Pill. So very Canadian. Has Jay Baruchel in it. Yeah, this is a super Canadian movie.
That's funny. Yeah.
Wow, this looks really interesting.
Yeah, no,
I more so than Roommates.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, again, Roommates is not a great movie. I think it's a just okay comedy, and it is trying to be a comedy. It's a complete waste of the talents of Sarah Sherman. Hmm. Who I think is a genuine comedic genius. She's one of the best, most there's actually quite a few really talented people on Saturday Night Live right now.
Hmm.
And a lot of them are doing great work, but it feels like they understand Sarah Sherman is like Pee Wee Herman levels of bizarre. Hmm. And whenever they let her just go wild, it's a treat. And I feel like I'm waiting to see someone use Sarah Sherman in a movie correctly. Like, let her shine, let her do what she does and go absolutely nuts.
Hmm.
She's just playing like this dean of student life who's telling a story about these roommates as a cautionary tale, which is fine, but it's kind of a waste of her talents. But that's part of where they're trying to make it like just wacky and funny. Yeah, it's a movie that's a little bit at war with itself tonally, but I don't think it's a total wash. I really don't. Okay. I don't think it is a bad movie. I don't think it's a particularly good comedy, but it is a more interesting movie than I expected.
All right.
And I'll give it some credit for that. I think it deserves credit for that.
All right. I like that.
Yeah. Tell me about the movie I can't pronounce.
Eruptia?
Yeah, I'm not going to... I'm not even...
Eruptia. Eruptia. It's that's the Polish word for eruption. And volcanoes are a very important symbol in this movie. It's co-written and directed by Pete Oz, but it's also co-written by the stars because a lot of this movie seems improvised. Mm-hmm. It stars Charlie XCX, the pop star, as a character named Bethany, as she is she goes to Warsaw with her boyfriend Rob. Mm-hmm. Rob is there to propose marriage. He actually suggested they go to someplace much more romantic, but she said, let's go to Warsaw. And it turns out Bethany wanted to go to Warsaw because her best friend Nell, played by an actress named Lena Gora, lives there. And she wants to kind of reconnect with this best friend. And they talk a lot about how whenever they get together, a volcano erupts somewhere on Earth. And wouldn't
literally.
You know, literally, a volcano erupts. And wouldn't you know it, Mount Etna erupts when they get back together. They see this as some sort of like cosmic sign that they're meant to just hang out perpetually. They're essentially trying to take their maybe post high school or post college party phase and continue it indefinitely.
To clarify the premise here, because I'm a little confused. Every time they get together, a volcano erupts, right?
So, yeah, somewhere in the world. Yeah,
but do we mean like every time they like see each other after they haven't seen each other in weeks, or like every time like, okay, I'll see you at lunch and then a volcano erupts at lunch?
No, like when they, after a prolonged period, when they reunite, a volcano erupts.
Okay. So if they stay together, a volcano won't erupt.
I suppose so. If you want to put some rules on it.
Because
it
sounds like what you're saying is that as long as we're together, a volcano is currently pumping lava and or like a giant, you know, plume into the atmosphere.
No, this is not seen as like a disaster is going to happen. They see it as something very dramatic happens. Their energy.
People die in volcanoes.
Okay, get over it.
Okay. And I'm sorry.
That's not part of this movie. Let me describe
it. It's such an interesting premise. It sounds like Colossal, like with Anne Hathaway. Okay, all right, fair enough.
Because the tone of this movie...
Don't get hung up on that.
Yeah, it's not about that. It's about how they see the volcano erupting as a very... a symbol of potency, a symbol of the importance of their relationship.
But it's mostly
allegory. They are rending the earth open with their relationship. So it's that dramatic.
Even though it's literal, it is mostly an allegory.
For them, it's a symbol.
I'm just saying the movie doesn't reckon with the literal quality of that.
No, because it's not a magical movie.
Every time they get together, there a volcano erupt? Okay, I'm done. You know what? I'm clearly distracted by the wrong thing. Yeah. I apologize. I don't mean to take over the
This is not a fantasy film.
I'm just going to shut the fuck up and just let you talk. I apologize. I just got really hung up.
Let me finish
on this.
Describing it. Yeah, and maybe, right? Maybe you'll get your head around it. But Rob, the boyfriend, gets a little frustrated because Bethany and Nell are now spending too much time together. He keeps playing, like, he's like, well, I knew we were going to come to Warsaw, so I got these dinner reservations at this really exclusive restaurant. It's hard. I just spent weeks on this waiting list to get into this. And she says, oh, by the way, we're going to go to a party. And then she just vanishes from the party so they can go clubbing together because she wants to hang out with her friend.
Right.
Bethany knows that the boyfriend wants to propose, and she's not comfortable with that, and so is trying to avoid him as much as possible.
Okay.
And they meet another American. This movie is in Polish, but it's mostly in English. So they're just sort of like bumming about Warsaw, and it has this really kind of freewheeling hangout quality where we're just sort of spending time in rooms, and we're kind of just drifting from party to party and having a lot of conversations, absorbing what the city is. And I love movies like that. I love movies that can sustain just sort of living in a place for an extended period.
Yeah, we get the real sense of what it's like to not only be with these characters, but be there.
Be there in that room. Also, just sort of see everyday life in a big city. It's not a picture postcard. It's not going to the tourist places. What is it like to be 22 years old hanging out in an apartment in Warsaw in 2026? This is what it looks like. And I appreciate the kind of earthy, natural, almost like guerrilla style filmmaking where we're just kind of wandering in. It feels very, very authentic. And it is very much about that post-college milieu where you're trying to... You're in a position where you know it's time to grow up, but you don't wanna.
You're gonna hang on to that last day of summer before school starts.
Exactly.
As long as I'm not going to bed.
And it's not just like I'm resistant to settling down. It's more like there is no magic in young romance. The magic comes from the friends that we had and the parties that we went to. And this is now backed up in our minds by the fact that we are altering the movement of magma in the earth whenever we hang out.
Uh-huh.
So, and when you're young, it can feel like that. Sometimes the friends you make do feel that important to you. And
It
was the friends you made along the way. And even more so than a romance, that those friendships can feel really that dramatic. And this is a movie about trying to capture in the most natural way possible the intensity of that. I love how late into the film we get, like we're about an hour into this movie, or like 50 minutes before we get the description of this is exactly what's happening with these volcanoes. And guess what? The movie is 71 minutes. We're almost done at that point.
That's wow. Yeah. 71, huh?
Yeah. It's real, real brief.
Nice.
Yeah. Breeze is in and out, gets really, really kind of hits hard with these,
ideas. I saw a new movie that was only 71 minutes.
It was pretty brief.
Nice. Does it feel like we got the whole movie?
It doesn't feel like it shortchanged anything.
71 is a really good running time. People don't give it enough credit. Like like a lot of like some of the best movies that we love ever, like Frankenstein, 71 minutes.
Yeah.
Or 72, whatever. Like,
we were talking about other Mummy movies. Some of those things are an hour.
Yeah.
Like 60 minutes long.
Yeah. And even those are padded. Yeah. It's like the first 15 minutes is just footage from the previous films.
They're really bad movies, by the way. Some of those Mummy sequels from the 40s.
Oh, the Mummy sequels are all pretty much all bad. Yeah. But like the first one's quite good.
The first Mummy, yeah.
Yeah, very, very haunting. Mm. You know? But no, okay, so good movie is what you're saying.
Good movie, oh, yeah. Okay. Really do. And Charlie XCX is everywhere. In fact, we didn't even bring it up, but she helped co-write some of the songs for Mother Mary.
Oh, yeah.
So those are Charlie XCX songs.
And she wrote some of the music for Wuthering Heights as well.
Yeah, and we also, just last week, talked about her appearance in Faces of Death.
Mm-hmm.
So she isn't everywhere right now. I think you take her role in Faces of Death, it's actually a very... very showy role. She plays like the mean girl in the office and is really kind of overacting and snarling a lot.
Only has like two scenes. But
She has nothing to do with the plot. It's not an important role, but she does kind of overplay it to sort of add a little bit of tone of nastiness to that movie.
Yeah.
And in this one, it actually kind of proves that she does have some range as an actress, mm-hmm. because she's actually underplaying a lot of it. She mm-hmm. knows that a film like this needs a little bit more of a natural style to it. She's a pop star, and she doesn't have any kind of diva qualities. She feels like a person.
I think the best pop stars often make really good actors, mm-hmm. because the best pop stars aren't just like...
Well, they're performing on stage, aren't they?
Well, they're performing on stage, but they're
performing
but,
like a persona.
Yeah, they're performing a persona, but also if they write their own songs in particular, they those are very... Like, the best songs, even pop songs, mm. are personal.
Yeah.
They're expressing something, and they're telling stories. Mm. So, yeah, it makes sense that, like, oh, David Bowie was a great actor, you know? Mm. It makes sense that Lady Gaga is actually a great actor, you know? So, it can work out. Okay, cool.
So, yeah, really, really dug your Ruptia.
Okay. All right, the last film we will be discussing is a documentary called Lorne.
Lorne.
It is about TV super producer Lorne Michaels, who a little over 50 years ago now co-created Saturday Night Live, which is...
That's still on.
It's still on. It's a big fucking deal. It's helped nurture and introduce a lot of the best comedians of the last half century into the popular consciousness.
Adam Sandler, in fact.
Adam Sandler, Bill Murray, Eddie Murphy, Dan Aykroyd, John Belushi, Will Ferrell, Robert Downey Jr., Joan Cusack that same season, the ill-fated season, where everyone but John Lovitz was fired.
Was it 86? It was around there.
That was actually your... So real, real fast, Lorne Michaels was... not particularly successful comedian and comedy writer who came up with the idea for a very loosey-goosey, very rebelliously spirited late-night program, which would have a lot of edgy sketch comedy and would have a lot of like really fascinating personalities involved. The show was, not right away, but was pretty quickly a hit. And because of its format, because... you know, it didn't really need to have the same cast over and over again. And in fact, new cast members coming in injected new life and new creativity into the enterprise. It can go on forever if it wants to. Like, it's got that built-in quality. And Lorne Michaels produced that for the better part of a decade and then left. And the show was produced by someone else from, like, the very late 70s through, like, the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. And it was right on the verge of being canceled because it kind of lost its way. And then they brought Lorne Michaels back. And Lorne Michaels, this isn't the focus of the movie or anything, but since we brought it up, his first thing he did was, okay, instead of getting a bunch of comedians, we're going to get a bunch of actors. Mm-hmm. And that's the season when he hired, like, Anthony Michael Hall and Robert Downey Jr. Mm-hmm. and Joan Cusack. And that season was legendarily bad. So much so that the final sketch of that season was Lorne Michaels telling the entire cast to like go into the go into the building and then setting it on fire, except John Lovitz, you can go. Which is very dark. Saturday Night Live is such a cultural institution that so much has been written about it. There have been oral histories.
There was a movie last year called Saturday Night.
I think that was actually 2 years ago now.
Maybe.
But it wasn't that long ago. Yeah, it was Jason Reitman did Saturday Night about the very first night of Saturday Night Live. It's pretty good.
I like the movie. It's got good energy. It's so propulsive. Yeah. The energy is infectious.
The energy is infectious. Yeah. The casting is mostly spot on. I don't necessarily think it's necessarily like a great story, but it feels like you're there. It feels like you're present. That's hard to track, and good for them. Also, for the 50th anniversary of Saturday Night Live, there were a whole bunch of documentaries about the making of Saturday Night Live throughout the years. There have been books written about Saturday Night Live. Every time there's an anniversary of Saturday Night Live, we have a bunch of magazine articles with brand new interviews of people who were there from the beginning.
I've joked that Saturday Night Live was just so great for one episode. After that first episode, it was all downhill. We actually had some of our listeners wrote, because we were whinging about how Saturday Night Live, if you watch it from beginning to end, a whole episode in broad daylight, you're wading through a lot of shit to get to like each episode was like maybe 13% good, and the rest is just you're patiently waiting through all this.
It's on at 11:30 on Saturday nights. Mm. You're supposed to stagger home drunk,
and
watch it then.
And one of our listeners wrote in and says, no, it needs to have that kind of immediate late night quality.
Yeah.
You watch it in the broad daylight, of course, it's not good.
No. I think something
more. But I still, Even if you watch it late at night, though.
Yeah, I know. Well, the thing is that there's a line, and I've heard it said for Saturday Night Live many times, and it's mentioned in this documentary, which I'll need to talk about the actual movie in a minute, but it's, we don't go on because we're ready, we go on because it's 11:30.
Yeah.
and that's true for a lot of Saturday Night Live, and a lot of, like, any classic Saturday Night Live sketch that you can think of. The Helvetica sketch with Ryan Gosling, or... I'm just trying to think of what's another great one. The cowbell sketch, for example.
Right.
Name another sketch from that episode.
That same episode. Yeah.
You're watching it because every once in a while, if you're lucky once an episode, or at least a few times a season, there's actual comedy gold that emerges from, we wrote this at 5 a.m. and we were completely losing our marbles and there's no way this should have fucking worked, but... we just stumbled onto some weird chemistry.
It feels like a comedy troupe figuring out what their material.
Yeah.
But the problem is we get to see all of the failed experiments while they find the good stuff.
Exactly. It's not very tight. But because every once in a while there's like a really classic one, even to this day, like the Beavis and Butthead sketch, not to pick another Ryan Gosling one, but that was really fucking funny.
Right.
It just rejuvenates it. It just makes you think, oh, Saturday Night Live, still got it, right? They still got it as much as it ever did.
Saturday Night Live never had it.
Well, I think it's an exaggeration, but I do think it's always been a mixed bag. But the good, like, you watch any episode with a classic sketch, you're going to find a bunch of not classic sketches that are completely forgettable. But it's the nature of the medium. Anyway, my point is that Saturday Night Live has been so disseminated and so cataloged. It's not like people haven't been talking about it. It's not like there's a secret history of Saturday Night Live that. If you're going to make a new documentary about Saturday Night Live or the producer of Saturday Night Live, which almost exclusively focuses on Saturday Night Live, what are you going to tell us that we don't know? And the answer from watching Lorne is nothing.
We're just talking about Saturday Night Live again.
Yeah, and it's if you've read any...
Do we at least get into, like, Kids in the Hall? Because he was responsible for that as well.
No, not at all.
We have all of the Kids in the Hall.
They talk about
Saturday Night Live cast members. It's been on for 50 years. A lot of them have passed on.
Yeah, I know.
Like, we have all the Kids in the Hall. Get them.
Well, some of them, I think two of them are interviewed for this. I think it's Mark McKinney and Bruce McCullough.
Okay.
But they were involved in Saturday Night Live. Bruce McCullough wrote it, and Mark McKinney was on the program for a while. Also, Mark McKinney in the Kids in the Hall movie was doing an impression of Lorne Michaels.
Yes.
Which a lot of people have done impressions of Lorne Michaels over the years, and that's all featured in the movie as well. And Lorne Michaels produced some movies, some of them Saturday Night Live movies, some of them not. I forgot he co-wrote Three Amigos.
That's right.
A movie I think is genuinely funny.
He was a comedy writer before he became a producer, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's basically Lorne Michaels is a... is kind of doesn't like talking about himself, and so he kind of won't. And a lot of the movie is just talking to other cast members and former writers of Saturday Night Live, kind of speculating about Lorne Michaels. And I'm like, I didn't need a movie to guess. Like, you should actually know some shit. And after a while, it just feels like, you know, we're seeing some behind the scenes stuff. But if you look at that SNL. Beyond SNL 50 documentary series that they did. There's this one episode of it. It's really good and you should see it. I think it's called The Writer's Room, or it's about The Writer's Room. It's The Writer something. And it's all about the making of one episode from beginning to end.
All right.
And that's really fascinating process. And it's also, even though that documentary was produced by NBC to celebrate Saturday Night Live, and by all rights should have been a total hagiography, the writers talk about how much it sucks. Like, why do we have to do the whole fucking thing at night? What the fuck? We don't have to work it. Why are we doing this? Why are we losing sleep? Why is the first thing we do every week, everyone sits on the floor of Lorne's office like we're toddlers and pitches ideas we're not going to use to the guest just to make the guest feel like they're part of the process, which wastes our time creating it. And then when the documentary Lorne talks about that same thing, everyone's like, oh, that's such a classic part of the process. Everyone loves that. And I'm like, no, actually. You're really not delving. You're not questioning. We're not actually finding out anything terribly interesting. If you know nothing about Saturday Night Live, this is a bit of a primer. But if you know nothing about Saturday Night Live, you're not going to want to see a documentary about Saturday Night Live. and you've probably, and if you do want to see a documentary of Saturday Night Live, if you do like Saturday Night Live, you probably read something. You've probably seen something.
Yeah.
There's tons of documentaries about it, TV and otherwise. What are we doing here?
Saturday Night Live has the same really obnoxious habit that that Disney does, mm-hmm. in that they love to celebrate themselves.
Yeah.
Disney is one of the only companies I know that will put out a compilation record called We Love Disney. It's like Saturday Night Live. Here's a Saturday Night Live special where we're going to Saturday Night Live more Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. And remember these same sketches you've been watching this for the same 50 fucking years?
Yeah. Now all the good ones are in one place.
Yeah.
Which admittedly is very helpful.
And every 5 years they tack on like that one that caused a bit of a stir, but it's the same 10 that you had in the last couple of specials.
Yeah.
Oh my God. It's like they keep on insisting that Saturday Night Live is great.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that says that is itself.
I disagree with that, and I'll say this right now. I'll agree
I know a lot of comedians want to get on Saturday Night Live.
I think it's a cultural institution at this point.
The exposure of it.
No, I think it's a cultural institution at this point.
It's a school.
You're not wrong.
It's something comedians need to pass through.
But there's a reason why some colleges are famous.
Yeah.
Like Juilliard is a big deal for actors, you know? Like,
yeah.
So Saturday Night Live, if you can get on that show, it's that level of exposure, and you can actually, like, be creative on it and build your own sort of identity or brand, if you want to get so mercenary about it, that's a big deal. And I think if you look at what Saturday Night Live hath wrought, the actors it has given us, the talent it has given us, the movies it has given us. A lot of Blues Brothers is a great movie. Wayne's World is a great movie. These are all successes.
And you know what? I'm glad that Kenan Thompson has been riding the gravy train for like, what is he, 20 years now? Like, he's been on that show a long time.
I think he's the longest running cast member. Well, he should be.
Oh, he broke the record a while ago, and he's still going. So, and I like Kenan Thompson.
He's
so
great.
Keep him on there.
Yeah, no. Yeah, good for him. Honestly,
give him that steady paycheck.
If he's
forever,
happy, if he's happy, keep him happy.
He's happy and he's funny, and he keeps on turning out good work. So, yeah, fine.
I will say this. Lorne is a nothing burger of a documentary. Mm. It's not like hard to watch or anything like that, but it's nothing special. But I do want to segue. Have you seen any of the Saturday Night Live UK series that just debuted?
Oh goodness, no. I'm not interested in the American series.
Yeah, yeah. It's really funny.
Is it? Okay.
It's got that anarchy spirit back again. I think that Saturday Night Live used to have, where it's a bunch of young comedians who are allowed to be fucking weird.
There are certain sketch comedy shows that when they launch really do push the envelope. They do something really strange. And I remember seeing a lot of sketch comedy shows start up at some point. I remember in Living Color.
Yeah.
And how great that was right at the start. How revolutionary that show felt.
Genuinely revolutionary.
There's a show we covered on Cancel Too Soon. I'm fond of it. Nobody else is, called The Edge.
Yeah.
From the mid-90s. Well, it was Julie Brown's show. And it was like super violent and weird.
And it was so mean to like some of the things that lampooned that Aaron Spelling got it canceled.
Yeah.
Like, he was like, you made fun of my shows. Fuck you.
And he said, like, don't do that. And they just did it harder. So, of course, they got canceled. When Mad TV first started, that felt really kind of out on the edge.
I don't know about Mad TV. Whitest Kids You Know.
Even Kids in the Hall. Like, that only lasted, I think, 4 or 5 seasons.
That's pretty good for a sketch comedy series. I mean, Saturday Night Live, lasted for so long, it's, like, absurd.
Or The State. Like, that also only lasted, like, 2 or 3 seasons. And the reason why these things burn out so quickly is because you can only sustain that kind of energy for so long.
Right.
The fact that Saturday Night Live has gone on for as long as it has is a testament for how much it sucks.
Well, no, I'm just saying this right now. I think when you can only
how irrelevant it's become.
You can only sustain that kind of energy for so long because people are human and they burn out, or they run out of ideas, or at least they need a break. Saturday Night Live cycles people out. Kids in the Hall is just those guys.
Yeah, it's just those five.
Monty Python was just those guys and Connie Booth.
And Carol Cleveland.
I'm sorry, Carol Cleveland. Yeah. Who's Connie Booth?
Well, Connie Booth was part of it. She was John Cleese's wife on Fawlty Towers.
That's okay.
In real life, and also also.
But
on
you're right.
Fawlty
you're
Towers.
Right. In Monty Python was more Cal Cleveland. Saturday Night Live, they cycled actors out more quickly, and so the revolving door of talent. I think it didn't always work out, and they've definitely had big lulls, but there was always, like, a couple of years down the road, all of a sudden, they got a great cast. Like, all of a sudden, you got Phil Hartman, Mike Myers, Chris Farley, like, and people, it's just firing on all cylinders for a while. And that's because those people were great. Then they burn out. And
I know you're listing the comedians from, like, when you were 16, which is when everybody latches on to Saturday Night Live.
Well, because that's when it's on when you're currently watching it. But I'm sorry, man, like, reruns were on. I have seen the 70s show. And when those early, the early episodes, the first few seasons, when they were, like, actually, like, really blowing up racism or just doing super bizarre shit with bees that had nothing to do with anything, that felt very, very much seat of your pants.
Yeah.
And that's when that show was, there was a lot of it that sucked, but when it was good, it was fucking amazing. Every once in a while, Saturday Night Live hits another run like that, and that makes it feel like it's worth waiting a couple of years. Which isn't great, but the point is that over 50 years, hey, they've had enough of those like a big deal.
If you wait a couple of years, it might be good for a year.
That's true for a lot of anything that lasts that long.
That's
though.
True. Like, you'd say the same thing about The Simpsons.
The Simpsons are comics. Yeah. Like, you know, like, oh, like, there's quite a few years where Spider-Man was pretty uninteresting, and then there was an amazing run. We had like 50 issues where it was absolutely phenomenal, and then those creators left, and then it was just kind of okay for a while, and then someone else came up with something new, and when it goes on for a long time, you will have a lull, but you have the freedom to have a lull, because you are allowed to, as opposed to the second it flags even a little, we're done.
Yeah.
I think there's room for that, and I think Saturday Night Live works mostly in that regard. But anyway, I would
just argue that the best sketch comedy shows burn out fast. Mm-hmm. You know, look at Mr. Show, or heck, even something like, you know, bizarre stuff like Wonder Shows, and these shows come along, and either the writers run out of ideas, like they just put them all in there at once, and they kind of bowl you over with how many ideas, and then they just are kind of done saying what they had to say.
Well, it
was so out on the edge that it didn't have a big audience, and it only grew in years later when other weirdos found it.
Yeah. Well, in any case, much more interesting to talk about Saturday Night Live than it is to talk about Lorne. I think it's the overall,
I suppose,
takeaway. Let's review our movies on the critically acclaimed scale. We review every movie we review on a scale of C- to C+, so that we will never, ever be on a poster. C- is below average. These are movies that we don't recommend. A C is average. These are movies that are, you know, some good, some bad. And then a C+ is above average. These are movies that may not be perfect, but we genuinely recommend them, whether we love them or just think they're quite good. On that note, Lorne, it is an unenthusiastic C-.
Okay.
In that I don't hate it or anything like that. It just, it's not mediocre, it's insubstantial, which is the problem for a documentary. Like, it just passably watchable would be fine, but you're a documentary. I should be informed about something, and I could get almost all of this movie from a Wikipedia page. Like, it doesn't really do what it sets out to do. It's very frustrating. Eruptia.
I give it a C+. Eruptia, yeah,
close enough.
I'm giving it a C+. I really like that. I like just sort of how laid back it is, and yet how it does feel like it does leave this very gentle impact about human relationships and friendships, especially sort of that teetering on the brink of boredom, trying to recapture a sense of 20s excitement that you feel kind of waning. I think that captures that really, really well.
Roommates. Roommates is why I'm glad we don't have a binary system. Because there's a lot of stuff to like about it, and there's a lot of stuff that just doesn't work. The humor is just okay at best, and frankly, most of it doesn't land. But the character work is surprisingly interesting, and it's actually willing to explore just how kind of fucked up its comedic premise is. And I admire that about it, and I think that's a little subversive, so I'm going to give it a high C.
Okay.
It's a noble effort. Now we have Mother Mary.
I'm going to give it a... it's frustrating because I want to give it a C- just because I feel like I don't know where its head is at, but I am distracted by how frustratingly arty it is, and almost swept up in that.
It's kind of daring you to give it a C minus. Yeah, it makes you not want to.
So I'm going to give it a C just to spite it.
Yeah, I'm giving it a C as well. Mm. I think there's a lot to admire about it. It's gorgeous. The performances are excellent.
Michaela Cole is spot on.
She's fantastic. And honestly, kudos to Anne Hathaway. You know, she's quote unquote the big star. Mm. She lets Michaela Cole have the movie.
Yeah.
It's like she's like, no, this is the part as written. You are absolutely in control of every scene, and I'm going to let you have that. And that is it's a good dynamic. Mm. They work well together on screen. Those performances are fantastic. It is pretentious in a way that didn't bore me, but also pretentious in a way that didn't feel like it felt like they wanted credit for bringing ideas up, but not actually going anywhere with
it.
So I don't feel like it works at the level it really wants to work on. But it's not a loss. I do think it's an interesting film in many regards. So I'm going to give it a C as well.
All right.
And then lastly, Lee Cronin's The Mummy.
I'm also going to give it a C. It's problematic for all the reasons we went through. It is too long, but gosh, the violence is just so exhilarating. Yeah. And the horror stuff is so strong. It really is a good, you know, barf up your popcorn kind of a movie. And I look for those. I like those movies. So, I'm going to give it a C.
Yeah, if this was a tighter production, I genuinely think...
If it were tighter and it actually bothered to have, like, a real politic, it could have been a great movie. Especially if it kept all that gnarly gore in there.
Yeah. Well, in any case, I agree. I'm going to give it a C as well. But it's a high C. It certainly is. It's one of those Cs that, like... If you're a gore hound, to you it might be a C+, but I think overall it's a C. And that is it for Critically Acclaimed. We'll be back next week with reviews of more movies, including the Michael Jackson biopic, Michael.
Yeah, I've seen that one already. I look forward to talking about it.
Yeah, I look forward. I haven't seen it yet. I'm seeing it in a couple of days. And, of course, we will review it after our listeners have had a chance to see it as well.
But we can't talk about it. There's, like, a pretty strict embargo on this one. So I can say that I've seen it and give you no impression of my opinion. No,
they don't want anyone in the audience to know what happened to Michael Jackson. It's like, we know what happened to him.
I can say that it's part one of a series, so we only get a portion of Michael Jackson's life.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
This takes it from the 60s through 1984.
Oh.
Yeah.
I really didn't know that.
Hmm.
Huh. Okay, interesting. Well, in any case, that's coming up. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you for joining us. Huge shout out to our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We're incredibly grateful to you. You keep the show running. Anyone who can afford to help the show out financially is a wonderful person in our book. You keep these shows going. We literally couldn't do them without you. So thank you to everybody who supports us. Thank you to everybody who signs up. If you want to support the show but can't afford to, very reasonable, please leave us a review wherever you find us online. I don't think we've had a new review on Apple Podcasts in a hot minute, so that'd be cool. Or you can sign up to our Patreon for free and get a weekly newsletter and get links to all of our latest work and just keep abreast of what's going on in the world of Critically Acclaimed. Also, if you want to discuss anything with us, you want to ask us questions, you want to take us to task for anything, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box? Yeah,
send us a physical letter, postcard, whatever you like, to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yep, we might read your letter or email on an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, thank you everybody for listening. Thank you. We hope you have a wonderful week. We hope you have a wonderful life. And never forget, everyone is a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?